The result of the painful events recorded in chapter 27 was the disruption of Isaac and Rebekah's home. It is safe to say that no one involved in the situation that is recorded in that chapter understood at that time the severity of that disruption. Deception, unbelief, all of these matters had come into play. Rebekah certainly held the view that Jacob's departure, which she urged, would be for only a short time. That as soon as Esau settled down, that she would send for him and everything would be as it had been. Esau, for his part, did not believe his father would live much longer. After all, Isaac's half-brother Ishmael had died at the age of 137, and that was about the age that Isaac was at this point. So he thought his father wouldn't live too much longer, and of course his father was of that same opinion. And Esau, as we read at the end of the previous chapter, was anxious, if you will, for those days of mourning to come, because he believed they would give him the opportunity to murder Jacob and to succeed in Jacob's stead to the blessing that Esau believed rightly belonged to him as the older son. Isaac, for his part, was aware, finally, about how far he had strayed from that which God had revealed to him and Rebekah many years before. That the elder would serve the younger. Isaac had gotten away from that revelation. He had preferred Esau over Jacob. And Isaac, having been awakened to this reality, was determined in his mind that his former ways of evaluating the relationship between him and his twin sons would be discarded. Isaac knew that he had been called to be a prophet of God, and that the calling he had received was to advance the cause of the messianic promise that was to Abraham and to his seed. And we will have cause to consider that promise again in this passage today. But it's safe to say that not even Isaac could comprehend the cost that his years of backsliding and delaying and preferring Esau over Jacob were going to exact from his family. The paths of Jacob and Esau had already been following much different directions, even while they lived with their parents. But those paths were about to become much more diverse from each other. In order that Jacob should not follow Esau's path in choosing a wife, Rebekah urged Isaac to send Jacob away from home and to send him to a suitable place in which to find a bride. This, of course, was the pretext for having Jacob leave anyway, because Rebekah knew he had to get away. So he was to be sent to the home of family members in a distant place, to the home of Laban. And already there was the awareness of a distinction between the family of Abraham and the people of the land in which they lived, and in which God had promised them a great inheritance. Isaac's family was aware that they were separated in some respect from the people who lived around them. Rebekah knew that Jacob must not follow Esau's example. That Jacob must not marry somebody from that land in which Isaac and his family were living. It was the land that had been promised to Abraham and to Isaac, but they were very much strangers in it, and they knew it. And so the situation arose that Jacob came to leave behind his home, and especially the protection of his mother. He did not realize on the day he left that he would never see his mother again in this world. That was part of the cost for the grand deception. But though Jacob was not yet himself fully aware of all that God had purposed for him, and indeed of all that God was doing in his life, it was still the case, and here is that which I trust will encourage you today, it was still the case that the decree of God concerning him would stand. He had been, from before his birth, the object of God's sovereign grace. We began this series by looking at that text in Romans chapter 9. Before they could do anything, before they were born, God said it was his purpose that the elder would serve the younger. And so it would come to pass in ways in which these people could not yet deserve. At the same time, in the life of Esau, there arose a telling sign of what happens in a life that has repudiated the revelation of God and resolves to achieve his own purposes in defiance of whatever God has said. That was Esau's life. And so it was that the man who already had displayed tremendous carnality and worldliness undertook even more devices in that way. His first wives had been a source of grief to his parents. You can read of that again at the end of the previous chapter, where Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth." And earlier in that chapter, as we saw, or in chapter 25, as we saw earlier, Esau married two women from Canaan, and we read there that they were a grief to his parents. But then we read here in this passage that Esau sought a wife to add to his collection. And he thought perhaps that this one would be more acceptable to Isaac and Rebekah, because she was a direct descendant of Abraham through Ishmael. But it was the same scenario, you see. Esau was trying to get what he wanted through the devices of the flesh and through the reasoning of his own darkened heart. So when we come to this crucial transition in the lives of Jacob and Esau, and particularly in the life of Jacob, we find set before us that which would continue to mark their paths in this world. Grace's wisdom versus carnality's folly. Grace's wisdom versus carnality's folly. Now in this situation, we begin to see unfolding the reality that God's purposes in Jacob's life were operating even though he didn't know it. Even though he didn't know it. Later in the same chapter, as we will see, he would have an experience of which he would say, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." The reality was the Lord was guiding him at every step of this journey. Here was God's grace to him. Not favor that he deserved. His actions in the previous chapter would be enough to tell you that he did not deserve to have God's favor. But nevertheless, for his own purposes, God had set his love upon this man. And even though Jacob did not know all the details of how God was leading him, the reality was God was leading him. So even before Jacob understood it, even before he knew really much about God at all in a personal way, God was directing his steps. His mind at this point in time was focused really on the immediate need, and that was to get away from Esau so as not to be murdered, as Abel had been murdered by Cain many, many generations before. Jacob was actually taking the path, though, that God had marked out for him. So even though he didn't know what was going to unfold, and even though his concerns were totally different, God's grace was to be seen in the wisdom of God in leading Jacob away from his home to a place where he would be completely dependent on that grace and completely dependent on the revelation of God. Now there's a lesson for every person here, in that there are times when we cannot discern the reasons for our circumstances in our lives. Or times when we may think we understand the reasons for those circumstances. Jacob thought he did. He thought he understood why it was he was going on this journey. But he didn't really know. But even though we don't understand or understand wrongly, it is still the case that God makes no mistakes in dealing with His people. And displays His wisdom and His grace in a way that preserves them from their own wickedness and guides them through their lives to that to which He has called. Now, awareness of that truth is not easy to gain. We can give an academic assent to it here when we sit in the church. But there are circumstances every day of our lives that try our trust in this reality. But the awareness of this truth ought to compel us, even in those circumstances, to trust in the Lord, as Solomon said, with all our hearts. It ought to lead those who have not yet trusted in the Lord to do so without delay. Here is a great contrast. And this great contrast appears vividly in that which we find in this passage. And I want you to notice the three things that we find in this passage that underscore this contrast. First of all, let us notice the happiness of blessing. The happiness of blessing. And here we come to deal with Isaac. This is Isaac after the revival. Isaac after the moment of recognition that God had intervened to forestall His plans and His purposes. Here we come to deal with Isaac. And really, this is the last major look we have at Isaac in his life. All that really is left of Isaac's story in the scriptures after this time is the account of his death when his sons buried him. So this is the last time we really see Isaac, and it is encouraging to see him here, now fully in command of his senses as a prophet, fully understanding what God's purpose was. And this command with which Isaac sent Jacob away reveals the extent of this work that God had done in Isaac's heart. For you remember that in the previous chapter we saw that when Esau came in and when Isaac realized he had given his patriarchal blessing not to Esau but to Jacob, who was pretending to be Esau, when Isaac realized that, he trembled exceedingly. He woke up, as it were, with a start to the reality of God's revelation. And then he said to his son, I have blessed him before you came, yea, and he shall be blessed. So there was the indication at that point that Isaac understood God had intervened, and God was going to make his purpose to prevail, not Isaac's purpose to prevail. And so it was that Isaac delivered a charge to Jacob, not realizing that here would be the last contact he would have with Jacob for many years. Isaac thought, as Rebecca, it's going away for a little while. But it would be many years before they would see each other again. It was clear from what Isaac said here that he understood that Jacob was to be the continuation of the line through which Messiah would enter the world. And I find that in particularly in one reference here in verse 4, where Isaac referred to the seed. Give thee the blessing of Abraham, to thee and to thy seed with thee. And if we turn to Galatians and to chapter 3, Galatians chapter 3, now I'm looking for the reference here when he speaks about to the seeds, not to the seeds with 16. Okay, thank you. Now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. Now here was the New Testament commentary then on that which Isaac himself had come to understand, that the promise was made to Abraham and to his seed, meaning ultimately to Christ. So Isaac understood that it was through Jacob that Christ was going to come. It was through Jacob that Messiah was going to enter the world. So when Isaac looked at his son, to the extent that he could see him, he said his eyes were dim, his vision was limited, but to the extent that he could see him, when he looked at his son and heard his son, felt his son, what he saw with his prophet's eye was the promise of the coming Redeemer. And what was Isaac's anxiety regarding that promise? That Jacob's line would not be mingled with the people of Canaan, with the idolaters who lived all around them. So Isaac understood that as surely as he and Rebekah had been separated in the midst of the people in the land, so surely Jacob must be separated. That was not the case with Esau, but it was to be the case with Jacob. But we have to notice as well, in addition to the instructions that Isaac gave here to Jacob, for those instructions themselves were full of the wisdom of God, that Isaac also repeated the blessing that he had already given to Jacob. He hadn't realized the entirety of the circumstance in the incident recorded in the previous chapter, but now he confirms this blessing. Notice the language here. Verse 3, God Almighty bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people. Here was the blessing that was promised to Abraham, that from Abraham there would spring descendants who would be as numerous as the sands on the seashore. So Isaac was saying to Jacob, God make you a multitude of people. And in verse 4, give thee the blessing of Abraham. So I say, this is remarkable now that not only is Isaac confirming it, but that he is specifying it in these terms concerning the coming seed. So in this reference to the blessing of Abraham, here was that which set Jacob apart. He was to inherit himself the blessing that God had given to Abraham. What was that blessing? Abraham was to be the father of all the faithful. We know that to be so because that is the commentary in the New Testament. He was to be the father of all the faithful. The land in which Isaac and Rebekah lived was going to be theirs in and through the work of the Redeemer. So now it came the time for Jacob to go away with his father's blessing. Not now with his father's blessing having been obtained only by a subterfuge, but now with his father's blessing comforting him, confirming him, giving him full knowledge. I think you can say that Jacob's spirits no doubt rose as he considered going away with this glorious blessing pronounced upon him, even though Jacob didn't really know what lay before him. Could scarcely imagine what the subsequent years would bring. But to know the blessing of God was for him to be able to travel away from home with contentment in his heart. That's why I speak about the happiness of blessing. It is the happy case of people who know the blessing of God to be contented. To know that Jehovah is your God. To know that Jehovah has revealed Himself to you through the written Scriptures and through the incarnate Word. To know that God has purposed to bless you and to lead you in the right way is to know the contentment that whatever happens in your life, you are in the will of God. I suggest to you that this is a contentment that for many people is absent. They don't have that contentment. That sense of divine direction. I wonder if you are among those who lack it today. Do you know the direction of God today as it has been revealed in the Word? Are you in the way of grace? Jacob was. He was by no means perfect, as we're going to find out. But he was in the way of grace. And that brings me to the second thing I want to emphasize in these verses, and that is the humility of submission. Already, changes in Jacob are appearing here. When we read in verse 5, Isaac sent away Jacob, and he wept. Now, as surely as we should be struck by the fact that in verses 1 to 4 we find the last substantive view of Isaac, so surely we should be struck by the fact that in verse 5 we find all concerning Jacob's actions that we find in these 9 verses. This is all we find about Jacob here. That having received this charge from his father, he went away. So Isaac sent Jacob away, and Jacob went where his father had directed him to go. We read in verse 7 that Esau saw that Jacob obeyed his father and his mother. So here was the mark of Jacob now. It was the mark of obedience. The fruit of God's gracious intervention. In spite of the wicked scheme that Rebekah had concocted, and that we'll get to Rachel eventually, and that Jacob had carried out. It was a wicked scheme. But in spite of that, God had overruled their wickedness. Not to endorse their wickedness. I pointed it out before and I would emphasize it again. God was not endorsing that scheme in that which took place. But God intervened to overrule it. And so for the first time now, Jacob was being guided in the way of God's direction at the voice of Isaac. So his journey began with the expression of humble submission to his father. He did what his father said. Whatever reluctance Jacob may have felt when his mother first suggested this idea, when his father said what he should do, he went. He did not comprehend all that this journey would mean for him. He didn't know all those circumstances that lay there in that far-off land. But even before he had any great wrestlings with God himself, Jacob displayed here a willingness to be bound by the counsel of the aged prophet who was his father, and to submit himself to the will of God through his father. And I say here, is the sign that God's grace is on a life. It's easy to resort to your own reasonings when what you need to do is to follow the revelation of God. Jacob came to the place of following what God was telling him to do. And though he did not have a full awareness of all that was in his life at that time, yet the very fact of his obedience and the humility of it and the submissiveness of it is a remarkable thing when we consider the name of this man means the supplanter, the deceiver. And the conduct of Jacob in this instance as he leaves home provides a stark contrast to the conduct of Esau. And it is to that third thing in the passage to which we now come, the haughtiness of unbelief. Jacob is a model of humility and submission. Esau is a model of haughtiness. So we read about Esau's actions beginning in verse 6. Esau saw what went on. He saw that Isaac had sent Jacob away and had blessed him. He saw what was going to happen in Jacob's life. And he heard that word, "You're not to take a wife of the daughters of Canaan." He saw that Jacob was gone. He understood that his wives that he had taken were not pleasing to Isaac and Rebekah. So he decided to add another one. Now there's some debate among commentators as to why Esau behaved as he did. There are some who believed that he was so angry with Isaac for having cut him out, as it were. And knowing that his parents were already upset with him about his first two wives, he decided he would antagonize them even more by taking another wife from the daughters of the land. Another one of whom they would be sure to disapprove. But there are other commentators, and I think that they probably form the bulk of the opinion on this motive, who suggest that what Esau did was become pragmatic. And he saw that Isaac and Rebekah didn't like the first two wives that he had chosen. And so he decided to find a woman that he thought they would like better. And so he went to the family of Ishmael. Yes, Isaac's deceased half-brother, Ishmael. He went to that family and took as a third wife the daughter of Ishmael, or a descendant, at least, of Ishmael. Sometimes daughter refers not to an immediate generation follower. Might have been a granddaughter, but at least it was in the direct line of Ishmael's family. And so Esau may have been thinking here, well, Abraham's son is Ishmael, and by marrying someone who's linked to Abraham, I will gain greater acceptance in the eyes of my mother and father. Now remember, as we pointed out before, it's hard for me to keep this in my own mind, but remember, we're not talking about people who had just become adults here. We know that Isaac was in advanced years at this time. So Jacob and Esau were as well, because he was 60 when they were born. So Esau may have thought, well, this is a way to remove the objections to me on account of my other wives. So Esau said, I'll show Isaac that I can be an obedient son too. But whatever his motives, his choice fell on yet another woman who was well schooled in the ways of the land, in the ways of the Canaanites. So her influence would continue to be poisonous in the family. So it wasn't exactly a way to improve the situation. In fact, Esau simply compounded the problems that he faced by taking a third wife to the other two that he already had. Here was the action of a man who wasn't really thinking at all in terms of the ways of God or of the coming of the promised seed or anything to do with that. He was thinking only about what would be to his advantage going forward, so that when his father would come to die, he, not Jacob, would be in position to gain the large inheritance that was going to come to them. Here was a man who did not care at all about the Word of God or about the ways of God. What he was after was that which would advance his cause. It was unbelief that drove Esau. And the haughtiness of the depraved heart asserted itself again here. I'll fix the problem. I know just what to do. And whether it was to express his displeasure or whether it was to gain their favor, the favor of his parents, what he did was folly. And that is the reality always. When you go and take into your own hands what you imagine to be the solution to your problems, it is folly. So we come now to the place where the home is broken up. Jacob leaves. Esau takes a third wife. And all the problems that that brought into the household. And Esau began developing his own holdings, his own livestock. He spent his days as a hunter, looking after his increasing number of descendants. And Isaac was left really by himself. In his last years, Rebekah came to die. And so there was nothing that Isaac had but the sense of loss. And yet, in the midst of that loss, here was the reality that Isaac could see. God was overruling. The purpose for Christ to come was not derailed. It was not set aside. Christ would still come. Christ would still redeem His people from all iniquity. And as a prophet, as Isaac saw the reality that Christ was going to come, his own soul, whatever the disappointments of his own life were, his own soul could rejoice. That even though he would come to leave this scene of time, even though he would come to be laid in his own grave, even though he would not live to see the fulfillment of the promise, he could know that the promise was going to be fulfilled. Christ was going to come. Now that encourages me when we think of the circumstances we face in our own time. Because there are many situations where we can say, what is the use? What is the use of continuing on? Everything is going to destruction. What is the use of continuing on? But we do it as Isaac did it, with the prophet's eye. Christ's purpose will be achieved. He will save his people. He will build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Here then is the call for the people of God today to trust in their God. In the words of that song that we sang, let us say also, let God arise and let his enemies be scattered. Let us look unto him and rest in him. For he will accomplish all that he has purposed to the glory of his own name.